Welcome back to the American Revolution Podcast, Episode 29, The Siege of St. John. So this is the late Tuesday edition. I recorded this episode last night, and I just absolutely hated how it came out. So I got home from work. I'm trying this one more time. You'll probably be hearing this if you download and listen immediately. It'll probably be out Wednesday morning. So where we last left off, Brigadier General Richard Montgomery had gained positions on both the north and south ends of Fort St. John. Montgomery had sent John Brown after he captured the Lalapraya Road farther down the road towards the St. Lawrence River. Seth Warner will follow, and they'll camp across Montreal at a town known as Longueuil. Now, I'm just going to cut for a second and say that I am 99% sure that I'm pronouncing the name of this town wrong, but in all my research, I can't find a phonetic breakdown of how to pronounce the name of this town. So I'm just going to assume that it is, by best guess, Longueuil. It is currently today a suburb of Montreal because in modern era, Montreal has expanded far beyond its original walled-in boundaries that it had during colonial times. So, Longueuil is a small town on the opposite side of the St. Lawrence River. They do have a nice little frontier fort that the Patriots will take advantage of. I'm sure it's quite a surprise for the native Canadians living in Montreal to look across the river the next day and see a camp full of Patriots, let alone the British Redcoats. So the situation, at least for the Patriots in Canada, is really on the uptick. After the very eventful day of September 18th, Montgomery learns that he is now the senior officer in Canada. Philip Schuyler will have to return to New York with a severe fever and rheumatic pains, probably stemming from his gout. Now, Philip Schuyler would retain overall department command, but Montgomery is the senior field commander, and so he's the man making decisions on the fly when it pertains to military matters in Canada. One of his first orders was to have Ethan Allen go out along the Richelieu, gather volunteers. He was also ordered to gauge what is the local feelings towards the Patriots. Are they going to join with them? Are they going to turn on them? Or are they going to keep staying neutral? Well, Allen goes out and reportedly gathers 250 men in just about 3 days. He then takes his force and joins John Brown at Longueuil. Now, let's just take stock of the commanders in the town. We have Ethan Allen, John Brown, Seth Warner. We have three very dynamic personalities, and you've told them to just wait and hold their position. Yeah, I really can't see what's going to possibly go wrong. Well, surprise, surprise, when something does go wrong, it's usually Ethan Allen's fault. We all know that Ethan Allen can't stand still, so he comes up with this brilliant plan where he and John Brown will cross over to Montreal. They'll do some sort of military demonstration around the city, fire a couple of shots. Who knows, maybe the Canadians will throw open the gates and just let them in. But the whole purpose is that they believe that the Canadians are going to rally to the American sides. There are two problems with Ethan Allen's plan. Besides the obvious that it borders on the side of delusional, the first is that in Allen's head, he thinks that the Canadians are going to rally to him. But the problem is the people living in Montreal live there. It's their home. And you've started to threaten their home and their livelihood. So it's really no surprise when the Canadians rally behind the Union Jack. The second problem is, and this one is really not much of a surprise, Ethan Allen is on his own. Now, some people say that John Brown got the times wrong, or there was a miscommunication and the times were wrong, so Ethan Allen went over, but John Brown never followed. A popular belief and one that this man, I mean, we all know how much I love Ethan Allen. I believe that he didn't tell John Brown the right day and he went a day early. He told him, oh, you're going to go across, you know, we're going to go across at this day on this time. And I'm going to do it the day before because the Canadians in my head are going to open up the gates and I will be the conquering hero on my own. That was a bit of a long-winded rant. I apologize. But it's pretty much what happens. So Carleton gathers up whatever British regulars he has, loyalists, and the large group of volunteers that will join up just because they want to protect the city. And he has about 600 men, and they're ready to meet Allen. So they come out, marching out of the city. Allen looks out, sees this very large force, and retreats to Long Point. Now, it is a defensible position. I will give him credit, he did pick good ground. But the fight doesn't last long. He has about 250 men, the British about 600. He has the advantage of the ground, but he does not have the advantage of guns, because half of Allen's fighting force isn't even armed with a musket. And now let's face it, even in the colonial era, if someone's shooting at you and you don't have a gun, you're running for the hills. And that's exactly what happens. When the shooting starts, those without guns make a run for it. Those that are kind of iffy on the situation, saying like, maybe I don't want to stay here for this, they take off. Allen is captured with a handful of hardliners, and they are taken back to Montreal. Now, those that went against the Canadians, they'll be moved out of Montreal. There isn't a large-scale public execution. There is some imprisonments, at least for some of the leadership, and especially Ethan Allen. So, by all intents and purposes, Ethan Allen, his time is finally done in the American Revolution. So Long Point was quite a disaster for the Patriots, and we'll get more into it. Because by the beginning of October, Canadian partisan resolve had begun to cool, and Long Point was not very helpful. Montgomery decided that he had to get these men involved. So he orders James Livingston to take 250 of his Canadian Patriots and build a battery on the east side of the Richelieu. Montgomery's thinking is twofold. First, you are now exposing the eastern side of the fort to cannon fire, along with the ships that the British had docked or anchored in front of the fort as an extra battery or extra protection for the fort in case of rebel bombardment. So now you expose the three row galleys plus the Royal Savage to Patriot guns. The second is, who else is in that fort? I mean, it's not just regulars. It's Canadian loyalists. And so they're looking out. They see their brethren, other Canadians, working with the Patriots. You might see some dampening of the spirits or maybe a dip in morale, knowing that they may not want to fight other Canadians. Livingston is very willing to the task, but he's kind of worried about how his men are going to handle themselves in a fight. But he'll get his answer. You see, on the second day of construction, the British out of Fort St. John send a small force to try and disperse the Canadians and to disrupt the construction of the battery. Except the Canadians, they put up a good fight. They really put up a scrap. And they force the British to leave, even with their support of one of the rogue galleys. So the Canadians have proved themselves, Livingston is satisfied, and when Preston tries two other attacks, he's fully confident in his men, and of course, they drive away the British. So the Canadian battery is well underway of being constructed. But while Livingston is caught up building the Canadian battery, something has to be done about the other Canadian partisans in the area. And so Montgomery orders New Hampshire Colonel Timothy Bedell to assume responsibility for these men. You see, many of the Canadians are still without guns, so Bedell really works to get these men firearms. He goes out, tries to either buy the pieces from the local citizenry or trade for them, anything to do to get guns in the hands of these Canadian patriots. Montgomery, meanwhile, is fully focused on the siege and has, you know, nothing else on the mind but taking Fort St. John. It's the key to the whole operation. He realizes that he has men north of the fort, south of the fort, east of the fort. If there's four cardinal directions, there's only one other thing to do. And he puts another battery on the western side of the fort. While he's constructing another battery and preparing for the all-out bombardment of St. John, he's fighting another battle. This time, it's a political one. You see, the yo-yo that is the people of Montreal, and I use yo-yo in the most respectable terms possible, because they would flip sides as many times as they would change their underpants. He gets word from a very prominent citizen, St. Luc de la Corne, that the Montreal Canadians are very interested in the Patriot cause, and if Montgomery could just get, you know, to Montreal, the people would rally behind him, and they could kick out the British, and they'll join their side. But this is the same song and dance that Montgomery's heard before, so he's cautious. And lo and behold, after the Long Point battle, LaCorne and at least several other prominent citizens rally behind the Union Jack. So Montgomery is feeling the pressure from his officers that if he doesn't move soon, he could have a mutiny on his hands. But Montgomery is pessimistic of the army's ability to capture the fort. The fort is a very well-fortified position, to put, you know, an obvious label on it. And so he has to be absolutely positive that he can take the position without significant damage to his supplies, his equipment, and most of all, his rank and file. If he loses too many men, then he loses any ability to capture Montreal or even Quebec. So he's very cautious. But he has to do something. And this is where James Livingston comes in again. You see, the Northern Army was running very low on powder and shot, and as many times as Montgomery would send word to Schuyler, Schuyler was just not getting the supplies up to Montgomery fast enough. It's not Schuyler's fault, he's trying really hard, but the supply lines have to come a long way, for one, and two, he was getting stonewalled from a lot of places to get the supplies that he needed for his army. So Montgomery needs powder and shot, because if he can't keep up a steady fire, he cannot keep up a siege. Now, some of the parts of the siege are successful. Something I didn't mention, it's kind of a footnote to the whole story. The Royal Savage is damaged and takes on water and actually sinks. It'll be re-risen and used again later on, but for right now, the Royal Savage is out of commission, and the other rogue galleys, well, they're not, you know, without their battle scars either. So the siege is working, at least against British equipment. Whether it's damaging the morale inside the fort is yet to be seen. Well, James Livingston comes up with this great idea. He says, what about Fort Chambly? By all accounts, Fort Chambly has quote-unquote warlike stores. Fort Chambly only houses 83 soldiers and the families of said soldiers, and also the families of some of the soldiers in St. John. Now, Fort Chambly from the outside looks like a rather impressive fort. It has stone walls, it has large parapets, but they're paper thin. See, these stone walls were built to protect against Indian attacks. They weren't built for any kind of large-scale siege, and the Canadians know it. So John Brown and Jeremiah Dugan is actually Livingston's second-in-command, are chosen to lead the mission. Livingston is still working with the Canadian battery, so he has his second go. Dugan will lead 300 Canadian patriots, John Brown another 50 Continentals, and he'll bring two cannons along. The troops surround the fort, and on October 17th, at 2 a.m., the shelling of Fort Chambly begins. It's not long before a breach is created, and Major Stopford, the officer in charge of the fort, offers to capitulate the following day. Now, the funny thing is that he had no idea that the Patriots were very close to running out of shot. They breach the walls, and the British capitulate. Mission accomplished. So as of October 19th, the rebels occupy Fort Chambly, and the stores of powder and shot went to where they were needed for the Siege of St. John. But the muskets in the fort, well, they were made sure to be distributed among the Canadian Patriots, because there was still a fair amount that were without muskets. The soldiers and the families that were captured inside the fort, well, they're sent upriver to the St. Lawrence, and they're going to be sent behind American lines, where the soldiers will eventually be paroled, and the families will be sent back once operations are done, or at least moved to friendly British lines where they'll be looked after. Remember, this is a more civil time, so you're not going to see any kind of harm come to these families. The one thing that Montgomery does that is actually a stroke of genius is he sends word to Major Preston that, well, we've captured Fort Chambly, and we're moving the prisoners and the families downriver, and they have to go past Fort St. John. So can you please allow these ships to pass? To which he allows, of course. He's not going to fire on the ships of his own men nor the families of his men. Now, Montgomery is crafty, because he didn't have to send them past St. John. I mean, going through the waters is a quicker and, for the most part, more direct route to where you're taking these prisoners and families. But he does it as almost an attack on the morale of the people inside the fort. Imagine knowing your family was at a fort, and you looked out and, oh, hi, they're passing in a boat manned by Patriots. What's up with that? So it's really not a surprise that it does do some damage to the morale of the Canadians inside the fort, because some of their families were in Fort Chambly. On October 27th, Montgomery builds another battery north of the fort. Now, I will say that I never said that there was a battery north of the fort, but there were John Brown and Seth Warner's men. So the north side of the fort was technically covered. Montgomery has a total of 750 men committed to the siege. He does receive some reinforcements. There are some New York troops, and there's the 1st Connecticut under Brigadier General David Wooster. Now, Governor Carleton is getting a lot of pressure by the Canadian loyalists. Do something, Carleton. They're taking all our forts. They've captured our soldiers, our families. Do something. And Carleton does come up with a plan. You see, he has 600 loyalists, 130 British regulars, with 80 Indians available to him. It's a pretty decent-sized force. He's going to take these men. He's going to jump in some canoe and bateau. They're going to cross the St. Lawrence River. And when they get to Long Wheel, they're going to defeat the Patriot force there, recapture the fort, the town. He's going to then move south. He wants to relieve Preston of his siege. And with that force, they're going to meet up with Colonel Alan McLean, who's operating in and around the Richelieu area. And with this very large combined force now, Carleton is going to move against the Northern Army and push them out of Canada. Like I said, it's a solid plan when you look at it on paper. So Carleton's men begin their crossing, except they're on a river. It's not like there is a very large element of surprise here. And Seth Warner sees what's happening. So he leaves a 30-man garrison behind in the fort. The rest of his men go with him, and they go to meet the British in what he sees as their probable landing zone is going to be. So, Warner is in position, the British are approaching, and before they can even get anywhere near land, Warner and his men are hammering them in the boats. It's a furious firefight, and the British have no choice but to retreat. Not all the boats get away. You see, I don't know how it kind of happens, but several boats carrying loyalists and Indians actually land on shore. Maybe they couldn't hear the orders from their commanders, or maybe they didn't see what was going on around them, but they actually land at Long Wheel, or at least on the southern side of the town, and they are met with the most ferocious fire from the Patriots. I mean, they are just hammering into them. Several are killed, and the rest surrender, and they had no choice. But you still have this larger force floating around, and, well, they see that a large Patriot force is in front of them. Wonder what's at the fort. At least Carleton thinks that Warner must have taken most of his men. If we can get our force close to the fort, then we can overtake the fort and we'll still have the fort. Leave Seth Warner no choice but to pull back, because he can't lay siege to Fort Langweil, at least with that large British force in front of him. There's one thing Carleton did not account for. The 30 soldiers in the fort, they lay into the British. They let them have it. They are not about to give up this fort. And they hold out. And they hold out long enough for Warner to get there to join in the fight. And Carleton, stuck between a veritable rock and a hard case, he's stuck between the fort and Seth Warner. He has no choice but to retreat. This is a crushing defeat for mostly Carleton, but also for the morale of the loyalists in his army. When we look at the tail of the tape, the best guessed numbers are about 50 loyalists and Indians are killed, most of them coming from that failed landing, or at least the botched landing, of those few canoes against Seth Warner's men. So we have about 50 killed, wounded, or captured. On the Patriot side, we just have one man wounded. Now, as the old saying goes, history is written by the winners. So maybe the Patriots undersold their numbers. But the 50 loyalists and Indians killed or wounded, well, that sounds about right. Warner had handed the governor a significant defeat. Now, we had mentioned Colonel Allan McLean. He was sent to establish a loyalist camp at Sorrel. He brought with him about 100 Royal Highlanders, and in the weeks that he was there, he recruited about 50 loyalists. Now, as part of Carleton's plan, he'd take his men, link up with Carleton as they relieved the Fort St. John, and then they would move against the Patriots in Canada. Well, almost immediately after they left camp, Canadians began to desert. Now, some think that with the fall of Chambly, it may have softened their fire, their resolve for the British cause, and they just want to go home. Others think that the Patriots were actually trying to send some of these guys into their ranks and file to get guns because, well, the Canadian Patriots had a shortage of muskets. So they got their guns, and then when they were marching through the woods, evaporated into the woods. But whatever the reason, once word about Carleton's defeat at the hands of Seth Warner reached McLean's men, all the Patriots decided to leave. So McLean is still standing there with his 100 Royal Highlanders. He has no way to take these men to break the siege, so he really has no choice and will return to Quebec City. So Fort St. John, by all intents and purposes, is completely on its own. So Montgomery sends a flag of truce and calls for a ceasefire on November 1st. He wants to know if the fort will capitulate. Now Major Preston, a British officer, will do his best to try and negotiate with him. And they will actually agree on surrender with honors. Montgomery just wants to get the fort in his hands because he knows that his enlistments are running out come January 1st. So on November 3rd at 8 a.m., Preston formally surrenders the fort. 700 soldiers, volunteers, militiamen, sailors, and women were all sent to New York. and they would all be eventually paroled or set free. Now, Montgomery is in a great position. He holds Forts Saint-Jean, Chambly, Longueuil. Now he has to turn his tide to the walled city of Montreal. He's pressed for time. It's November. Enlistments are up on January 1st. Montgomery has to make sure that he can capture Montreal and Quebec City in less than 2 months. He sends word to Schuyler that he is in this really sticky situation and he needs reinforcements. Schuyler, of course, aware of the situation, has been frantically sending word to Congress to get reinforcements sent north. Reinforcements would come, but it's not going to be an easy trip. That's going to do it for this episode. This is probably one of the longest episodes I've done, and I'm very proud of it. I am super happy about talking about the siege of Fort St. John, talking about the Canada campaign. Living in Maine, this was a big part of what we looked at, because we're going to talk about next week. There is a second force coming, and it's coming through the backwoods of Maine. So we're going to get into that. But I'm just super excited about these episodes on the Canadian campaign. I'm loving writing them. I'm loving doing them. And I just want to send a special shout out to one fan of the podcast who actually took the time to post a very kind message on Facebook telling me how much he enjoys the podcast. And I just want to take this moment to say, you don't have to do that. I don't need people to, you know, put posts up saying how great it is. I just want you guys to take a few seconds, go into iTunes. I know I've said it before. Drop me a 5-star rating, and this way it will actually expand who it goes out to. I want to try and reach as many people as possible with this podcast. This topic is something very near and dear to my heart, and I want to make sure that it gets to as many people as possible. So those 5-star ratings actually really help. One last thing I'm going to leave off on. If you have any questions, the Facebook is there. Just drop me a message or post a question. And if I can answer it, if it's something that we've talked about, you need it to be elaborated, I will gladly do so. If it's something that's we haven't talked about in our story arc yet, I'm going to say we're going to hold this question for when we get closer to that topic or when we actually discuss that topic. I'll make sure I bring it up in the podcast itself. We're going to leave off with this episode with a quick book recommendation, and that's Benedict Arnold's Army, the 1775 American Invasion of Canada During the American Revolution. If you just look up Benedict Arnold's Army, you'll probably find it. The subtitle is rather long, but it's by Arthur S. Lefkowitz, and it's a book that I haven't read personally. But it's definitely one on my list to read, and it is one highly recommended by many of my friends at the Saratoga National Historical Park. So we're going to end it here tonight. I will be posting the episode first thing in the morning, so look for it. And I hope that everyone has a great weekend, and we will have a new episode come Monday or Tuesday. And as always, make sure you keep your powder dry.